There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician. Did he hit Austin? My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
Just want to do things my own way, you know.
We're going to stay in the 80s for a little bit longer here. Oh, wait a minute, did that cool Talking Heads record come out in like 77? It was the late 70s, wasn't it? We're traveling back in time tonight. Yeah! Can't seem to face up to the fact. I'm tense and nervous and I can't relax.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is Phil Pritchett on the P2 Podcast. Broadcasting in high definition audio to all spaces and glorious spots on this little greenish blue planet of ours. From Trinidad World Recording Studios, my beautiful studio here in Fort Worth, Texas. Welcome, fans. Welcome, welcome. Man, have you been enjoying the podcasts? We've just been back in full force, man. Here at the end of 2012, beginning of 2013, we resolved, man. We'd gotten behind. We had, I had that movie I was working on. I had several albums I was working on. Playing a lot. I just got behind on the podcast after keeping it a weekly kind of deal for 3 years or so. I just said, man, we've got to kick it in. You know what did it, man? Was just out there playing shows. And so many of you folks come up to me just going, man, where's the podcast, man? I'm checking back. I don't hear it. You know, and we had the station down there in Houston, our friend Matt Matthews, North Houston, who played the show. Our friend Kevin McCoy, who played the show here in Fort Worth. So I was on some stations. And, man, those guys moved on. Matthews is no longer at that station. And, just a couple things kind of went down to where, frankly, I just had a hard time getting up the gumption to keep it going and delivering it on time, et cetera, et cetera. But, man, so many of y'all at the shows were like, man, where's the podcast, man? Come on. I always look for it, you know, and I said, man, even if it's not like on certain stations for extended periods of time, we're going to keep it going here for the fans, man, and for my own sanity, man. I get a lot out of this. Talking about stuff and just sort of, you know, taking stock in what's going on out there in the world of Texas music, the world of rock and roll, the world of family, and all else that encompasses this life of mine and of yours. Well, our thanks to Shane Hollinger for coming by once more. Great, legendary Texas DJ over there on the ranch playing music. Blake Walker, our beloved road manager. Oh, God, the world's worst brainwashed Aggie. Those are his words, not mine. So it's great to see these guys again. We got a lot of guys, people lined up. I've been rejuvenated out there playing shows, talking to you guys. Man, I wanted to do a little a show here on this book I've read. Now, I hope that you out there listening think, oh, here's Phil. Here's Phil. We love him. Mr. Highland Park High School, goes to Southwestern College, man. Always talking about, oh man, what did we talk? We talked about Atlas Shrugged on here. We talked about how I read Moby Dick. Those are probably the two biggest books ever written in the world. I resolved to read them several years ago. I'd read parts of them, of course, in high school and elsewhere. But, literature, a little literature, always weaving its way into the podcast. Undaunted Courage, I'd read recently, the Lewis and Clark story. Great book. So I'm always reading something, and I want to share here. But, man, it gives me great pleasure. Great pleasure to bring this into the Phil Pritchett Book Corner and put it on your reading list. Because this takes it down a notch, man. Take your epic literature and just toss it in the trash can. Yes, I've got everything from For Whom the Bell Tolls to Huckleberry Finn at my bedside table. And, you know, sometimes I can't get into them. I've read them before in my life. I'm like, gosh, I'm trying to read it again. I don't know. It's not taking off. You know how sometimes you pick up a book, you get about 20, 30, 50, 100 pages into it, you just go, God, I just can't pick it up. It's not happening. It's not happening for me right now. Well, let me tell you what, man. Someone gave me this book. Luke Ayers, our drummer from the full band who played on the live record, said, man, he was reading this book, and my friend Wes Cunningham raved about this book. Said it's a quick read. Pick it up. And, man, it is Red, My Uncensored Life in Rock, Sammy Hagar's autobiography. Sammy Hagar. Now, just a second here, you're thinking, oh, God, Phil, what are you trying to dumb this whole thing down? You're trying to take it, come down off your pedestal, off your high perch there of literary excellence, of distinguished thought, to read about Sammy Hagar. Oh, man, absolutely, that's what I did. And let me tell you what, man, I've not been more entertained reading a book in a long time. And, man, some people gave me, we talked about Keith Richards' book, Life, that somebody gave me. And, man, I confess, couldn't get into it. Couldn't get into the damn thing. And you know what it is, and we'll get into this more in Sammy's book. I don't know how mature Hagar is. What I mean by that is, you know, a lot of these guys are so proud of their idiocy, of their stupidity, that it's a little off-putting at some time. No one loves a great hotel thrashing story more than me, or I woke up in the yard, you know, with a couple other people not wearing any clothes. I love stories like that as much as the next person. But, you know, you get those stories in like the Johnny Cash autobiography, but Cash comes through it, man. He gives it up. And he looks back on his life. And in that Johnny Cash book, or the Dylan book, I feel like there is reflection. There's redemption. There's wisdom is the result of that. But a guy like Keith is still so proud of all this stuff. He's still doing a lot of it. And it comes off like reading some 18-year-old high school guy's book about his exploits. And so that some of that, it wears me out to an extent, and it's a long book, Richards' autobiography, Life. So Sammy is more in the Keith Richards vein. I guess it's just not as sinister or something. It's a little more fun. Hagar is a lot more grounded guy. He's a lot smarter guy, and it's more readable. He seems more like a real person, whereas Richards, you're just reading one just crazy thing after another, and it wears me out. So I don't know. Sammy's sort of an everyman. He's very likable. I've never been the biggest Sammy Hagar musical fan, but man, was always astounded by his reputation. Man, he was a great live act. Man, I mean, like growing up in Dallas, he had like the Texas Jam. Oh man, over at the Cotton Bowl, they always had headliners, and it was all day festival. One of the all day festival deals. No seating on the football field. They just stand there with the old fire hose, just hosing down the crowd in August in Dallas. But man, the guy that just always the next day I was talking about was always Sammy Hagar. You know, the Red Rock. Oh man, he came out with, you know, Ted Nugent or something, and just blew the whole. Man, he just ran all over the stage. He was a great performer. You know, not that much of a writer, but a pretty good guitar player, pretty good, and a good singer. Of course, he came up, you know, doing his own thing with the band Montrose out of L.A., and they had some success in the 70s and early 80s, and then he went solo and just toured forever with his own band, just under his own name, Sammy Hagar. He always wore red guitars. He was the Red Rocker, and had a I Can't Drive 55 and Three Lock Box and Heavy Metal and all these. You know, had several hits, and then, of course, of keen interest to me was where he joins Van Halen. Now, I wasn't as big a fan as the Hagar era Van Halen as I was of the David Lee Roth Van Halen, but this book offers just great insight into the Van Halen world and universe that left me pining for more and just floored by what I found out. Man, Hagar just came from nothing, man. I think he grew up in California. Dad was a boxer and a drunk, really sad kind of upbringing. But for some reason, Sammy, young Sammy, he talks about in his book himself, he just always was kind of had a good attitude, had a good outlook on life, was very positive, was very hardworking, man. He'd always just had jobs, always saved his money, always hustled for work, and always had ambitions and didn't, just didn't get depressed. And I think some of his brothers and sisters had a lot harder time in life, growing up like they did. But Sammy, man, for whatever reason, he just kind of had that spirit about him. And, it's very appealing to read about, kind of just how he works his way up, man. He repeatedly just goes all in on these things. It's shocking. But he's just, you know, those guys in life that are just winners. I mean, everything works out for that guy. He has no money in his pocket, but he just moves on to the next thing. He's just positive. It's going to work, man. Come on. And he gets everybody excited and he gets everybody going. And, man, Hagar was that guy. I mean, he's starving. He gets his first record deal. He just takes every last penny and just goes and buys a Porsche and just spends all night just driving around. The next thing he goes, all I had was this Porsche. He's like, man, I could not buy peanut butter, but I had a Porsche just like I always wanted. And that was it, man. Things just started to work from there. I just started there. There's another point in the book where he's just up there at some, you know, I think it was up there next to Eddie Van Halen, like at the Van Halen, or maybe in his early solo career. And he sees this house on a cliff, this cool modern house. He goes, man, I had no money in my pocket. Zero. But the house was for sale. It's like, you know, 800 grand or something on the cliffs of Malibu or wherever it was. He just goes, man, I just had to have it. I went to the radio station. I went to the record company and said, man, go ahead and advance me for my next 3-4 records, take out a loan, sell the Porsche, whatever. And he just buys this house. Stuff that just has ruined people. But he kind of lived that whole way, just in this fearless fashion where you just think, gosh, that would just ruin people. You know, he would never advise anybody to do that. But somehow with Sammy Hagar, it was going to work out, and he knew it was going to work out. You know, later on, people, you've probably heard about, Cabo Wabo Cantina down in, Cabo San Lucas in Mexico. Sammy's famous for getting that whole town going in his bar down there. But it was a disaster for a long time. Great stories about that in there. But he, once again, man, just goes all in. He just, man, we're doing this bar thing. Well, you know, I'm going to get the Chili Peppers down here. And his buddies in the Chili Peppers and Van Halen, we're going to kick this thing. And, man, it's just, he just presses on. And it just, by this time in the book, you just know that, man, this is going to work. This is going to work. And he starts his own tequila. You know, how many people have gone broke trying to make booze? But, man, he just forces it through, man. And that tequila deal, the Cabo Wabo tequila is kind of what recently has made him a fortune. I mean, he made maybe $100 million after he got the tequila thing rolling and sold it to a big distributor, sold his brand, sold his label. And man, he's just been a tremendous success. It's staggering the kind of money the guy made and the kind of dollars that were made by those guys, man, like the 70s, 80s, 90s in the big volume CD era. He was on the Monsters of Rock tour with Van Halen. I mean, just huge touring, just jets, tour buses. It's all here in Red, My Uncensored Life in Rock. So Sammy, just a winner and a guy that held the band together. Well, he was just a leader in the band. God, every band needs a guy like that. Every band's got Keith Richards, just some guy that's too drunk to play. Those guys are in large number. You know, the Beatles, John Lennon, he was always kind of strung out. In the later years. So the bands need someone who is going to show up for meetings, who is going to go wake up the drummer, who is going to hold somebody to account, who is going to fire a roadie. There's that famous story of Don Henley for the Eagles. Henley, of course, was one of the singers and the drummer for the Eagles, and just kind of a tough old Texas guy, Don Henley. I mean, he used to go play gigs when he was a kid with a Switchblade and a motorcycle chain in his pocket, man. And he would just wield that stuff coming out of a bar at night. And, was, you know, a little guy, little musician guy, but a pretty tough customer. Yeah, and there's this one, great story where Don Henley finds a roadie. It's some gig at Eagles gig, smoking a joint, kind of enjoying himself. And Henley just throws him up against the wall. He goes, "What do you think you're doing?" The guy's like, "Man, I'm just, you know, having a good time." And Henley just grabs the joint out of his hand and throws it down and goes, "Getting stoned's the band's job," and just fires the guy. So, you know, somebody in the band has to do that. And you can see from his time in Montrose and his solo work and Van Halen, that is always Sammy Hagar. He's always the guy. "Hey, man, let's get together. Let's work on some songs. Come on, guys. You know, we can do it. And wake up. Let's go." The Red Rocker, man. No wonder he's been so successful in his life. It's kind of life-affirming in that way. You know, everybody thinks, "Oh, I'll be a rock star. You gotta be some just, you know, comatose heroin addict." That's it. He gets all the money. You know, the Stones or something, man. Mick Jagger's very much that guy. I know he parties and stuff like that, but man, he's very much a business guy. He shows up, he works hard, he hustles, he stays in shape, and is very, knowledgeable about his business practices, and he meets up with his lawyers and management. As does our man, Sammy Hagar. Man, some of the great stuff in here, some spoiler alert stuff if you plan on reading the book. Man, besides, I just loved it, like I said, going all in on stuff, was just astounding to me. That was kind of a consistent theme throughout his life. In fact, one of the coolest things was he was recording a record in L.A. and in one of the rooms down the hall. This is after, maybe right after he joined Van Halen or late in his solo career, he had a lot of success. And I was recording at the studio, and none other than Pink Floyd is down at the other end of the studio. So Hagar goes, "Man, I pull up to the studio one day in my red Ferrari, and all the guys in Pink Floyd are out there with their coffee and their cigarettes, and they're all going, 'Oh, man, hey, all right, you know, great. Oh, love the ride, all right, man, what you got there?' So Hagar goes, 'Man, I kind of showed off my Ferrari that day.'" And one of the guys in Pink Floyd, Nick Mason or someone, he's a big collector, and they talk cars, and Hagar goes, "Man, I went in the studio, just picked up the phone, just dialed my guy in San Diego who has all my cars." Turns out Sammy has like 15 custom-made Ferraris or something. He goes, "Man, the next day I just had a truck, put all 15 of my Ferraris on the truck, drove up to L.A. He just goes, "Man, I drove a different Ferrari every day to the studio because I knew Pink Floyd would be sitting out there watching me roll up." Come on, man. That's rock and roll. Hell yeah. Today, you're lucky if you can buy a pickup truck as leader of a rock band or lease a Hyundai. But back in the 80s, man, you just picked a different color Ferrari, different year, and just drove it up there to, you know, kind of rub Pink Floyd's nose in the dirt a little bit. So there's Sammy in his Ferrari. So then he joins Van Halen. This whole Van Halen gets stuff rolling in the book. Now, anybody who knows me, I mean, I came up on Van Halen. I was just taking, you know, got my first guitar, took a couple lessons, back in the seventh grade. Van Halen's 1984. The Van Halen peak of the universe. You couldn't play guitar without just, you know, wanting to play Eruption and Eddie and Alex and all that. And man, this was hard for me because the Van Halen brothers, Alex, of course, the drummer, and Eddie, the great guitar player, are just so insane in this deal. Drunks, oh my God. You want to talk about a disaster? The brothers Van Halen. Sammy, and the bass player, of course, was Michael Anthony, kind of another level-headed Sammy Hagar kind of guy. And they're still buddies to this day. They've all had a falling out with Van Halen at this point, but, you know, Sammy and Mike hit it off. Then you had Eddie and Alex. And he just goes, "Man, it was just always trying to rehearse." You know, there's Sammy, ever the cracking the whip, trying to keep everybody going. He just goes, "Dude, rehearsals were just a mess." Their studio, Van Halen, Eddie's studio, is just solid cigarette butts, like an inch deep. Just burns in the carpet. Eddie just smoking the whole time, just playing, wanting to practice at like 4 in the morning, showing up, and he's drunk, and Alex is drunk, and they've already been in a fight. Like, one of them have blood all over their face. Like, what the hell happened? And he's like, "Oh, man, you know, we got in an argument." And he'd say it was always that kind of deal. It's just them fighting on the floor, punching themselves in the face. He goes, "Man, we break it up." A couple minutes later, they're hugging and crying. Just, "I love you, man." You know, just all that kind of stuff, man. Sammy goes, "Man, it was just wild as hell." Touring with Van Halen, I love the story of that Eddie and Alex would get so drunk during the day of the show, they had two nice leather recliners that they would put right behind the stage, and that's where Eddie and Alex would pass out every day at about 3 or 4 o'clock. And they would just lay there snoring, just a lit cigarette in each of their hands. The roadies would carefully take it out of the way. And around them was just, you know, managers and light crew and dudes with amps and stuff. Sammy's trying. He goes, everyone just moved right around, little island, just both of them there passed out, cold. And he said the only rule was you can't wake them up. You cannot wake them up under any circumstances because they'll get up and start drinking again, and they'll be so drunk they can't play the show. So we've got to wait till the opening act is done. And and then you just go, come on, man, come on. You just like jump on them and they pop up, just wow, just light a cigarette. But they've been asleep for, you know, 4 or 5 hours, hit the stage, and then they start drinking on stage and they can go from there. So that was the, kind of modus operandi for touring with Van Halen. He said they had a curtain behind Alex, and I've since gone back on YouTube and I've seen some stuff where you can see it kind of, it's like a shower, like a shower looks like behind Alex down the steps a little bit. Where he'd get up between songs, and they just had a couple of trash cans in there from the piss during the show, drinking so much. And, you know, Eddie just smoking and drinking crazy. They had underneath the stage, she said everyone would have a different tent. They had 4 tents down there, just filled with girls, just during the show. They'd be going downstairs and just stuff was going on. All the rock and roll stuff you can possibly imagine. He just goes, dude, that was just on the road with Van Halen, dude. Crikey. But man, it starts to get a little, sadder as you go a little bit. I mean, these Van Halen guys are married. They got kids. And then, man, an amazing story a little later in the book. Alex, the drummer, is just a crazy drunk. At his birthday one day, he stands up. They go to Benihana, and Alex just stands up, starts dancing on the table, and then falls onto like the grill, like the dude with the knife, and he's just flipping or flopping around like popcorn on the grill. He's like burns himself up, and Eddie's just like laughing, just like pouring beer on him while he's on the grill and flipping cigarettes. And Sammy's just like, man, it's just freaking messed up, man. Another time, I mean, Alex was going to the liquor store at like 2 in the morning and just buying a bottle of vodka and just drinking the whole thing in the aisle and then buying another bottle and going home. And just the craziest stuff. One time Alex, they're at rehearsal, and Alex opens up, I think it was something like 12 tall boy beers, and goes, man, I can shotgun all those beers in like 5 minutes. Like, whatever. So Alex just goes, pop, 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 just does them all. Boom. 12 pack of beer, 12 tall boys. And then Alex grabs a baseball bat and goes, hey, man, I'm going to show you guys a trick. And he was going to do the deal where you hold the bat, each end of the bat in your hands, and you jump in the air and move the bat under your feet like you're jumping rope, you know? And he does this. Sammy goes, I'm just sitting here watching him. He goes, he jumps. Of course, he just catches his feet. He just falls flat on his face, and he breaks open his face. There's blood everywhere. All the roadies are running around going, oh, my God, he's dead. He's dead. And so he'd been in the, you know, towards the end of his drinking years, Alex had been in surgery because he smashed up his face and he'd fallen on the Benihana grill. And just the wildest stuff you can imagine, dude. And so finally, Alex Van Halen's wife comes to Sammy and says, look, you're the only level-headed guy in this deal. We're all going to get together and we're going to have an intervention with Alex. The wife was noticing Alex would wake up at like 4 in the morning, go downstairs, drink a bottle of vodka, and come back up and go to sleep. That kind of stuff, man. Hard, hardcore. Smoked like 3 packs of cigarettes a day. So they have an intervention. And Sammy goes, man, it was really intense. It was a lot of emotions and everything. And they say, man, something's got to give here. You got kids and all this. And they say, Alex just sat there and heard him out, nodded his head, and Alex just kind of shrugged his shoulders, went into treatment, raised his hand, took the oath, and never drank again for the rest of his life. How about that? I was just like, no way. So Alex, man, just said, all right, enough. Still smokes like a chimney, of course, but just quit the drinking, man, just like that. And then you move on to the sad sight of Eddie, his guitar player brother, who does, I guess he just kind of never gets sober. The whole Van Halen thing with Sammy ends bad, and they're Sammy hears they're trying to bring back David Lee Roth and all this. He gets his feelings hurt and gets pissed off. And man, Eddie gets divorced during this time. Sammy talks about going to Eddie's house. There's no furniture in there. Eddie's like sleeping in the living room on the floor in the corner, like underneath a sweater. And he's like missing a tooth and, you know, strung out and on drugs and drunk and all this kind of stuff. And, it's really pathetically sad and, kind of heartbreaking for me as a big Eddie Van Halen fan. He said, and they do some reunion tours and stuff. He goes, man, they were a disaster. Eddie was just, beyond, we just couldn't, no one could be around him. I mean, he was just kicking the monitors off the stage, busting out windows. He couldn't play. He would just, he couldn't do anything. He was just hopelessly, you know, out of control. I think this last tour, Eddie Van Halen with David Lee Roth and stuff, the word was he had, sobered up and the shows have been, he's been very, he's been great on stage, but, took him a lot longer than he didn't just take the oath like his brother, and call it all off. But amazing rock and roll, insight, in all that kind of stuff, man. Another interesting part of the book is where he talks about opening his club in Cabo San Lucas. And, man, just what it was like. I've never been to Cabo, but it sounds just beautiful. It was a nothing town, like no buildings down there. When Sammy went down there first, he goes, man, you'd see a wave just like hit the beach and go back out and there'd just be like 30 red snapper just flopping around on the shore. He it was just kind of, he just goes, man, it was just the land of plenty. So Sammy just goes, man, we're going to open a bar here. And he does that. Of course, what happens in bars, the guy that he leaves to run it steals all the money, doesn't show up to work. He's running drugs out of the deal. So Sammy's always going down there. His manager's going, man, this thing's losing you 30 grand a month. Sammy's like, God, you know, Sammy buys a plane so he can go down there all the time. Disaster, disaster, disaster. Even though it's losing money, all the Van Halen guys are pissed. They're all, oh, I mean, you get this bar, you're making all this money, man. You didn't want us to be involved. So Sammy's like, dude, I'm losing my ass in this thing. But they won in, so they let Van Halen in on it. And it was a disaster for a long time. But sure enough, man, Sammy, ever the hard worker and grinder, man, he goes, man, I was going to see it through. He's going to make it work. Sammy starts going down there with the Van Halen guys and, you know, all his buddies from the Chili Peppers. And he has all these, he knows everybody. And, you know, playing gigs and stuff. There's one great rock and roll anecdote. And I'll leave you with this image because it was just a disturbing and arresting image of Stephen Stills. You know, the great Stephen Stills, Crosby, Stills, and Nash. But Stephen Stills is a notorious great singer-songwriter, 60s, 70s guy, but just was a, man, big-time drug addict. There were always rumors that he like had his nose rebuilt. He'd done so much cocaine and crazy stuff and was still that way. I think it was in this book. Someone's like, Sammy goes, man, I was going to get – Stills came down to play some shows. Once the bar got going, some L.A. People were flying down to, you know, fish and stay on the beach and go to the bar and things. And he said, man, Stephen Stills was coming down. And Sammy goes, I asked his manager. I said, hey, what is Stephen like? He goes, I was going to put some food backstage. The manager goes, Stephen likes cocaine. Sammy's just like, okay, I meant like to eat. So Stills shows up. He said it was like 100 degrees or 90 degrees down there. Stills is like overweight, sweating, and wearing like this big fur coat, just lumbering around, you know, just sweating, just all gacked up on coke. And, you know, gets through a few sets at the bar that night. He goes, man, it was just tense having Stills around. He was just edgy and weird and distant and messed up. And he said, man, after the set, he just grabs some people and some whiskey and a guitar and just goes, ah, just goes off into the dunes, man, just lumbering off into the mountains like at 3 a.m. Hagar goes, man, I didn't know where he was going. And so anyway, Hagar, at the end of one of these chapters, Sammy goes, man, we had to all get on this. So there was like, you know, one flight going in and out of Cabo, commercial flight a day. So Hagar goes, we're all on the plane the next morning or next afternoon to fly back to L.A. He goes, and if you miss this flight, you got to wait like 2 days, like maybe on the weekend or Monday or Tuesday they're in a flight. So they're taxiing down the runway, and all of a sudden people start screaming, going, hey, look out, we're out here, what? Hagar goes, man, look out the windows. What? Just from out of the brush, from out of the dunes, there he sees this figure this Bigfoot lumbering Sasquatch type guy weaving all over the tarmac, and he's wearing this big coat, and sure enough, there's Steven Stills, and he's just slow motion, just lumbering, just waving his arms at the plane, just ah. And so Hagar goes, runs up to the pilot, goes, "Hey man, can you stop, let this guy on, you know, Jesus." And Hagar goes, "Man, I could tell by the way he was moving that he's got the gout, man. That he's got," he said, "man, he was doing all these drugs and drinking and tequila and shellfish and all that." He goes, "Man, it can really make your joints swell up." He goes, "Anyway, Hagar," he goes, "dude, he had gout. He was just dragging his own corpse of a body across the scalding hot tarmac in his fur coat." And so Hagar goes, "Man, we just all reach out the plane. We just pull him. Hit pull his half dead sweaty body up onto the into the plane. Just drag." We said, "There's no seats on the plane. It's all booked up." So we just pull him into the aisle, like the one little aisle down there, in front of like the drink cart. We just flop him down, you know, and he's soaking wet. His eyes are wide open and dilated, red face, just sweat, like sunburn. He's got dirt all over him, like, you know, insect bites, like he just passed out in like the dunes or in the mountains or somewhere. Sammy goes, "Man, he just looked like death." I guess I thought he was going to die on the plane. It was just pitiful, man. Ah, this was an image that just kept me up at night. Steven Stills is a sweating, bloated corpse laying in the floor of that plane. Crikey, man. Sammy Hagar, "It's a Quick Read." When it was over, I was blue, man. I was just like, back to reading Hemingway. Blah, 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 blah. So pick it up, man. Red, My Uncensored Life in Rock. Sammy Hagar. I think you'll come away with an appreciation for Sammy. Maybe not for his artistic prowess, but a great performer and a guy that was just the glue that held all this stuff together, man, and kept it going. And just a phenomenal success story, man, on however you want to judge it. Album sales, how much money he made. I mean, everything he did, tequila to the bar, to Van Halen, to the his solo career, to every house he bought, every car he bought, he sold like for tons more than he bought it for. That's what he says in the book anyway. So who knows? But more power to him. Sammy Hagar, the Red Rocker. Well, folks, that is our podcast today. Phil Pritchett here. For crying out loud, email me, phil@philpritchett.com. Say, "Phil, come play for us." It could be me on the couch. That's way down on the price scale. Or the full band with keyboards and a horn section and a huge PA. That's further on up. There's such a spectrum. To have a Phil Pritchett and the full band show at your house, at your party, at your club, at your festival, at your ranch, at your arena, I don't care where you are, we're ready to go, man. Playing so many dates now, man. Me and the band are just playing all the time now, man. Doing this residency in Dallas and playing all over, man. So now is the time. Or call me, 817-733-5256. Come record at the studio. Always got stuff going on there. Mixing, recording, mastering, you name it. Well, have a great week, folks. We'll have more podcasts coming to you here very soon. 2013, the year of P2 and the full band and the podcast. And, of course, as always, you the fans. That's why we do it. Take care out there. We'll see you next week. Much tougher.